This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Donald Trump is forcefully rejecting allegations that he's responsible for Turkey's invasion of northeast Syria. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
To the president, it's simple. Turkey, Syria, and the Kurds have issues.
Let them work it out. We shouldn't be over there.
But he's facing backlash at home for abandoning the Kurds, who fought Islamic State militants alongside the U.S. Turkey considers them terrorists and is now attacking them. The president says they'll be fine.
I say this with great respect. They're no angels.
The criticism's coming from allies like Senate GOP chief Mitch McConnell.
The Kurds did the heavy lifting here.
And Lindsey Graham, who worries about the U.S. being isolationist.
To those who think the Mideast doesn't matter to America, remember 9/11.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
Meanwhile, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan pledged to continue a military operation into Syria ahead of a visit Thursday by high-level U.S. delegation led by Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who are intent on pushing Turkey to agree to a ceasefire. Thursday's talks in Ankara were reportedly arranged during a phone call between Erdogan and U.S. President Trump. Mr. Trump is calling for an immediate ceasefire and offering mediation to bring an end to Turkey's military operation, which began last week. Ankara launched Operation Peace Spring against the YPG, Syrian Kurdish militia, which Ankara deems as terrorist. However, Erdogan is dismissing Washington's efforts to end the operation. He said there are some leaders who are trying to mediate, and he said this during an address to Parliament. There has never been any such thing in the history of the Turkish Republic as the state sitting at the same table with a terror organization, he added. More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. Congressional Democratic Party lawmakers abruptly left the White House meeting with President Trump Wednesday concerning the crisis along the Turkish-Syrian border. The House Speaker told reporters that Mr. Trump had a meltdown in the cabinet room because of the number of Republicans who had joined Democrats on Capitol Hill in approving a resolution condemning the president's decision to withdraw U.S. forces from northeastern Syria.
I think that vote, the size of the vote, more than 2-1 of the Republicans voted to oppose what the president did, probably got to the president because he was shaken up by it.
The president called Pelosi a third-grade politician. According to those who attended, the White House said the president was measured, factual, and decisive, and said the meeting was productive after Pelosi and others left it. A former top State Department aide has told impeachment investigators that he resigned last week because he could no longer look the other way, as colleagues were denied professional support and respect. Michael McKinley was a career Foreign Service officer and top aide to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He said Wednesday that he was disturbed by administration efforts to obtain negative information on political opponents. McKinley said the department failed to support Foreign Service employees caught up in the Ukraine inquiry. McKinley was considered Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's de facto chief of staff, even though he was not directly involved in the Ukraine portfolio. House Democrats' impeachment probe is focused on efforts by President Trump to urge Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden and his family. Toxic PCBs linger in some schools while the EPA and lawmakers fail to act. That's a report filed by AP's Ed Donahue.
Documents examined by the AP show Washington has quietly abandoned efforts to rid schools of PCBs.
Did EPA nationwide respond adequately to the problem? No.
Judith Enck is a former EPA administrator.
We regularly found exceedances in these old schools, and these were a lot, very often in low-income neighborhoods.
Many older buildings have caulk, ceiling tile, and paint made with PCBs. Carrie Hornbuckle at the University of Iowa looked at the health impact at schools of PCBs.
And it could affect how children learn and their ability to learn. It also, because of its effect on the metabolic system, it could affect how children gain weight.
Members of Congress who promised 3 years ago to find money to help schools address PCBs and other pollutants never introduced legislation. I'm Ed Donahue.
And you can find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Mm-hmm. Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan peace talks were delayed Wednesday in Juba after an alleged attack in the Numba Mountains.
The government should withdraw its forces. Also, we need the government to release immediately the traders whom they have arrested and hand them over to SLM authorities.
Zambia's opposition UPND sees opening in the 2020 election after winning the Kaoma district election. Russia will host the first ever Russia-Africa summit next week in Sochi. Kenya opens second phase of a massive railway project. And a special advisor to Gambian President Adama Barrow resigns.
I'm not surprised because I have been observing and I've come to the realization that I don't think Mai was getting as much influence as he thought he was going to get.
Pasamba Jao is a Gambian political analyst, and Kenya rolls out a new cervical cancer vaccine targeting about 800,000 girls. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The SPLM North Rebel faction based in Sudan's Numba Mountains has suspended peace talks with Khartoum after military forces allegedly bombed several areas in the region and killed a sheikh on Tuesday. The talks were set to begin yesterday, Wednesday, in South Sudan's capital, Juba. The group's leader says the sustained bombing campaign shows that the Sudanese government's failure to respect the cessation of hostilities agreement that the parties signed last month. Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Amar Amoa, SPLM North Secretary General and a spokesperson for the group, told the reporters in Juba that his group will not take a part in any peace talks until there is a full investigation into the reported attack. He says for the last 10 days, Sudanese government forces have bombarded several areas of the Numba Mountains. Amoa says even after the attacks, the SPLM North is committed to respecting the cessation of hostilities agreement, but that his group will no longer negotiate with the Sudanese government unless Khartoum meets the group's demands, including a statement from Khartoum about the bombing campaign. Amoa says the SPLM North also demands that the Sudanese government fully commit to the signed cessation of hostilities agreement with the rebels.
Our coming back to negotiation table is bound by government decisions to clear all these things. The government should withdraw its forces and stop from gaining new ground by occupying new areas. Also, we need the government to release immediately the traders whom they have arrested with their all properties and hand them over to SLM authorities.
Amoa says the fresh attack included 25 armed land cruisers that attacked civilians in Korwaral, an area of the Numba Mountains controlled by the rebels. He says a chief named Sheikh Mohammed Afdal Fadil and one soldier were killed in the area, while at least 10 people are missing.
And we are asking the government also to make thorough investigation to the chief who has been assassinated because he rejected the passing of nomads in that new road which passes through farmlands.
The Sudanese government downplayed the accusations, blaming the attack on cattle herders. Speaking to reporters in Juba today, Mohammed Hassan Altais, a spokesman representing the transitional Sudanese government delegation at the peace, said the government has full knowledge of what he refers to as the incident and says the government will address it.
The incident happened at the context of local inhabitants who happened to be herders attacking local merchants. Some fell victim and got captured, and local goods were confiscated. The government regrets and condemns in the strongest terms these unfortunate events that keep happening in the area and in other parts of the country. We also regret that this event took place at a time when people are entering peace negotiations and the country and the whole region is united for the cause of peace in Sudan.
Hassan says the government will investigate the incident and hold those responsible accountable. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A special advisor to Gambian President Adamawa Barrow has resigned, leaving the government for the second time. Mai Ahmed Fati, who is also the head of the newly created Strategic Unit on Policy and Good Governance in the president's office, said he intends to concentrate on developing his own political party, the Gambia Moral Congress Party, the GMC. Panderumbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
8 months into his appointment as a special advisor to Barrow, Fati has called it quits.
I made the decision to resign on my own accord and on my own terms, following thorough consultation and reflection with my immediate family and the leadership of my party in both the Gambia and in the diaspora.
Fati's resignation followed his party's rejection of a statement made by former Vice President Fatoumata Jallow Tambajang, who claimed the parties that formed the coalition government had agreed to allow Barrow to stay in power for 5 years as required by the constitution. The GMC party said they were not aware of any meeting in which the purported agreement was reached. Barrow had campaigned to rule the Gambia for a 3-year transition. He also promised to step down after 3 years and not take part in future elections. Barrow has since walked away from his promises. He has been accused of consolidating his power with the formation of his National Youth Movement and Fans Club. Pa Samba Jau is a Gambian political activist.
I'm not surprised because I have been observing and I've come to the realization that I don't think Mai was getting as much influence as he thought he was going to get.
Sehu Mbalo, the deputy youth advisor to the president, welcomes Fati's resignation.
It's a welcome move because the reason that he has put forward is he wants to concentrate on his party. We have not seen any negative part of his resignation.
Fati was the first cabinet minister to be fired from Barrow's coalition government. No reasons were given for his removal as interior minister. Youth advisor Mbalo doesn't think that Fati's second departure from the administration suggests in any way that Barrow's support base is declining.
Not really. President Barrow right now, he is very comfortable with the team that he has. He's 100% concentrating on the National Development Plan, which is 2018-2021. They are concentrating on his work plans and also on the agenda. So therefore, President Barrow has nothing to worry about this thing.
Mbalo says Barrow has the public support to stay in power. He says he's confident that Barrow will win a re-election if he decides to run.
I can comfortably tell you that President Barrow is more comfortable today with his political activities and political career in the Gambia than the previous years, because the Gambian people have started recognizing what President Barrow aimed for the country, the freedom, the liberty, development, other issues.
Political activist Jau disagrees.
I'll be disappointed with the Gambians if they were to vote for Barrow again, because I think we all agree that if there is anything that Barrow has demonstrated is this lack of capacity to run that country. And he has disappointed the Gambian people.
Jau says Barrow failed to achieve genuine and meaningful change. He alleged that the Gambia under Barrow continues to suffer economic distress, high debt burden, and massive corruption. For VOA Africa, this is pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
A spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, says the party is looking forward to next year's presidential election. This after the UPND candidate won last week's Kaoma District Council chairperson election over the ruling Patriotic Front Party. Prior to the election, President Edgar Lungu reportedly claimed that about 380 UPND members in Kaoma Chitwa Ward had defected to the ruling Patriotic Front. UPND spokesman Charles Kakoma says the Kaoma election shows that Zambians have lost confidence in the leadership of President Lungu because he has failed to deliver on his promises.
Local government elections were won by the opposition United Party for National Development, led by President Hakainde Hichilema. The ruling party, led by President Edgar Lungu, despite all the state resources that they poured into the election, they lost. And prior to that, they were bragging that a lot of people had defected from the opposition to join the ruling party. But that was all stage managed. They used a lot of state resources, including looting the food reserve agency, where they looted the staple food, the maize, give to voters to bribe them. But it didn't work. They used the government vehicles, government fuel, government drivers. So on the ground, the people have shifted their support to the opposition UPND.
So what does this say now for your party, the UPND, in preparation for the coming presidential election next year?
This is a clear indication that this pattern of voting will continue up to the presidential and general election. People have lost confidence in the leadership of President Edgar Lungu, the Republican president, because he has failed to deliver on his promises. What people are seeing is just corruption. What people are seeing is an escalation in the prices of goods and services, including escalation in the staple food, the prices of staple food, the maize meal. Coupled with that, we have a situation where there is serious shortage of electricity.
Mr. Kakuma, what do you make of this comment by Nevers Momba of the Movement for Multi-Party Democracies, MMD, saying that, in fact, accusing the church in Zambia of being complicit to the political violence because the church has failed to participate in the political affairs in the country? Should the church really participate?
Well, I think people are looking forward to the church to provide the leadership, to guide the nation in this time of political violence. They cannot sit by and watch their members. Some of the people that have been victims of this political violence belong to the same churches. Some of them are being killed and belong to their churches. So they cannot just sit by and watch. That is why I believe that Dr. Mumba is saying that the church should not just sit by and watch, they should provide the leadership. And they have done that in the past by bringing together the political parties and reconciling them and making agreements. For example, when we are moving from the one-party state to a multi-party state, it was the church that initiated that, leading to Zambia coming out. A socialist one-party dictatorship to multi-party politics. So we are saying that Dr. Mumba, I believe, is saying that the church, again, must provide leadership instead of letting the situation go like this without any proper guidance from the church.
Charles Kakuma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 17th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 18 minutes past the hour. This month, Russia will host the first ever Russia-Africa summit in Sochi starting October the 23rd. The country's military and economic influence is growing in Africa. Jude Devermalt is the Africa Program Director at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He tells Reiki Stryak that Russia's might is still significantly less than other international players such as China and the United States.
Yeah, I think the Russian-Africa summit is an opportunity for Moscow to show that it is back in the game, to highlight its relationships with a number of African leaders. It's invited everyone. It's unclear yet who is going to be there. I'm sure at this event they will sign economic and security deals. Nigeria's already indicated that they intend to do that. Russia will try to present itself as a peacemaker, overseeing negotiations with the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam between Ethiopia and, and Egypt. And they will also try to show that Africans see the world similarly as they do.
For a long time, a lot of the conversation in American and European media anyway has focused on China's influence in Africa. Obviously, what does this mean with a third, quote unquote, third, I guess, player coming into the continent?
I think we have to look at Russia's influence and engagement quite separately from the U.S., Europe, and China. Russia is a relative minnow compared to these other countries. They have increased their financial investment significantly. That's true. They are now getting much more engaged in this security game. But I really think they pale in comparison to China or to the U.S. And I think it's actually not very helpful to include them in this pantheon of key partners for the African countries, in part because when the United States and other governments talk about great power competition, and they say Moscow in the same breath as Beijing or Washington or Brussels, I think they're doing a tremendous service to Vladimir Putin, who very much wants to present himself as a global power. And in the case of Africa, we can talk about the destabilizing effects of Russia, but really nowhere near the scale of China, U.S., or Europe.
It's more maybe viewing Russia through the lens of how important the U.S. Often tends to think they are, maybe, than actually how important they actually are at the moment in Africa.
Yes, exactly. Russia is not a near-peer competitor for the United States in Africa. Russia is not a great power great power in Africa. It is a bit player that is doing a number of things that are deeply destabilizing and concerning, but they're not playing the kind of role that it historically they did when they were the Soviet Union or relative to other players.
Joe Devermount is the Africa Program Director at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from New York. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta has officially opened the second phase of his flagship infrastructure project, a Chinese-funded and built railway that will eventually link the port of Mombasa to Uganda. The latest stretch of the track cost $1.5 billion and runs from Nairobi to the Rift Valley town of Naivasha. But critics say the cost of the railway is plunging Kenya into debt. Ruth Elmendor reports from Nairobi and Naivasha.
Waving the Kenyan flag, President Uhuru Kenyatta Wednesday inaugurated the second phase of the country's new railway. The president then joined the first ride and listened to the onboard announcements. The new track is 120 kilometers long and has 12 stations. Passengers can ride the trains, but the railway is mainly for cargo. The track will eventually lead to an inland container depot, from where containers will be distributed to Uganda and Rwanda and to South Sudan. The train stopped at every station, where a cheering crowd awaited the president. He promised them that the new railway will bring prosperity. He says that if the railway comes here, development also comes here. The cost of $1.5 billion for construction of the second phase comes up on top of the $3.2 billion spent for the first stretch from Mombasa to Nairobi. President Kenyatta says this money will be earned back by the economic development spurred on by the railway.
The completion of the Nairobi to Suswa section of the SGR project is expected to revolutionize the development of the surrounding areas.
The loans are with Chinese banks. Wu Peng is a Chinese ambassador to Kenya. He says in return, China is not only lending, but also investing in Kenya with the coming of the railway.
We encourage Chinese enterprises to invest in the Naivasha ICDs and the special economic zones.
The railway currently generates $75 million per year from passengers and cargo. At that pace, the loan will be paid back in 60 years. Kenya hopes to see revenues rise once the railway is connected to the neighboring countries. However, there's no timetable for construction of the third and final phase. Officials have yet to secure the financing. Ruth Elmendor for VOA News, Naivasha, Kenya.
At least 50,000 Kenyans are diagnosed every year with some form of cancer, as cervical cancer becomes the second leading killer among Kenyan women. Dr. Collins Dabo from the National Vaccines and Immunizations Program says cervical cancer is the only cancer that can be prevented through vaccines. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the Kenyan government is expected to roll out a new cervical cancer vaccine tomorrow, Friday, targeting about 800,000 girls.
As per the World Health Organization, WHO, at least 18 million people are diagnosed with cancer every year. That is nearly 990 people every day. And as the government rolls out the vaccine tomorrow, Friday, the exercise targets approximately 800,000 girls between the ages of 10 to 15 years. Speaking in Nairobi, Dr. Collins Tabo from the National Vaccine and Immunization Program said that the human papillomavirus, HPV, will help in reducing the number of women affected by the cervical cancer.
Cancer is a big problem for us, not just here, but globally. We have more than 18 million people getting cancer every year in the whole world. In Kenya alone, we have more than about close to 50,000 people. Amongst all of these, ladies and gentlemen, cervical cancer is the only cancer that is 100% preventable through vaccination.
According to the Ministry of Health in Kenya, 9 women die every day from cervical cancer, including those in the age group of 20s. Dr. Tabo says the HPV vaccine has the potential of reducing the burden of cervical cancer by 70%.
Cervical cancer is the leading cause of cancer deaths among women in the country. Nearly all the cervical cancer cases are actually caused by HPV infection. So if we're able to protect ourselves from that, then we're probably able to prevent most of the cancers that they were.
The HPV vaccine pilot vaccination in Kenya was carried out between 2013 and 2015 in Kitui County, covering 22,500 children of ages 9 to 11, resulting to 95% evidence-based success. A cervical cancer survivor, Millicent Kagonga, a mother of two, narrates her ordeal with cancer and how she survived it. She says cervical cancer broke her marriage as she contemplated committing suicide because of the society that treated her as a curse.
I lost my marriage, and having discharge was the cause of my mom breaking my marriage. I kept quiet for some time because of the stigma. The people were saying a lot of bad things in my community. If you are bleeding, it is a curse or it is a cane from God. I never wanted to talk about it. I decided to go to the hospital. I did my screening and it came out positive. I was very devastated. I wanted to kill myself and kill my children.
Health Cabinet Secretary Cecil Kariuki has called upon Kenyans to present themselves for regular checkup in order to reduce the number of cancer-related cases.
And therefore, presenting yourself for routine checkups becomes imperative. Cervical cancer is preventable through vaccination. The government of Kenya, with the support of Gavi, we will be introducing this vaccine starting Friday to our routine immunization schedules of the year 2019 at a cost of 800 million shillings.
The highest rate of cervical cancer in Africa, standing at about 40 to 100,000, are found in East African countries. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. The rebel Sudan People's Liberation Movement, North Faction, based in Sudan's Nuba Mountains, has suspended peace talks in Juba with Khartoum officials after military forces allegedly bombed several areas in the region and killed a sheikh on Tuesday. The group's leader said the sustained attack shows the Sudanese government's failure to respect the cessation of hostilities agreement that the parties signed last month. Amua, SPLM North's Secretary General and spokesperson for the group, told reporters in Juba on Wednesday that his group will not take part in any peace talks until there is a full investigation into the attack. For the last 10 days, Amua said the Sudanese government forces bombarded several areas of the Nuba Mountains. A special advisor to Gambian President Adama Barrow has resigned, leaving the government for the second time. Mai Ahmed Fati, who is also the head of the newly created Strategic Unit on Policy and Good Governance in the president's office, said he intends to concentrate on forming his own political party. And that is it for this Thursday, October 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botti in Washington, saying have a good day, Africa.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.